Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Ana Mateo. Later, Steve Ember brings us the latest in the ongoing American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the English for a Specific Purpose series with John Russell.
By the year 2020, some 2 billion people in the world will be using English or learning to use it. Digital English language learning products and services are worth about $2.5 billion a year. That estimate comes from the British Council, an international cultural and educational program based in Britain. The increasing demand for English has led many people to explore careers in teaching the language. Being a native speaker is not necessary to teach English. In fact, some experts say that being a non-native speaker can be very useful when teaching English. Today, we speak with one of those experts. Her name is Bobby Cruchin. She is a certified teacher trainer for the Certificate of Language Teaching to Adults, or CELTA, from the University of Cambridge, Royal Society of Arts. Bobby Cruchin holds a master's degree in teaching English to speakers of other languages, or TESOL, from Hunter College in New York City. She has been teaching at the American Language Program at Columbia University since 1999. VOA Learning English spoke to her by telephone recently. Our interview has been shortened for the purposes of this program. How did you get into your teaching career?
So I got into my field by accident. I was actually an art student in Brazil, and when I started college, a school where I had studied ESL as an after-school program invited me to teach small kids. And I started teaching small kids, and I enjoyed it.
Where was the school?
That school is called Lollipop, and it's in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where I'm from.
How did you get from teaching at that school to teaching at Columbia University?
So I taught at that school, and then I transferred my major from art to languages. And then I went and I wanted to live in an English-speaking country. So I lived in the UK for a year where I did my CELTA training, which is a certificate program. Then I came back to Brazil. I continued teaching at a bigger school called Britannia. And then I started training teachers. I went from being a teacher to being a teacher trainer in Brazil, and I was training through the CELTA program. And then I moved to the U.S., and I decided to do a master's in TESOL. And then my career kind of took off. I taught at many different programs in New York as an adjunct professor until I got a full-time position at Columbia.
What skills do you need for your profession, aside from English language skills?
So I think first and foremost, yes, interpersonal communication skills, because teaching is all about teaching other people. And a great awareness of who my students are at many levels, like at a personal level, at an academic level, at a critical thinking skills level. So there is a lot of student awareness that goes hand in hand with teaching. So in other words, there is the content and the person who's right in front of you, and you are addressing the person. And then thinking of myself, I have to have great organizational skills to organize materials and the classes and the student assignments, so on and so forth. So I think if somebody wanted to go into teaching, they would have to think about being organized, having interpersonal skills, to some degree public speaking, because if you have a fear of speaking in front of other people, I wouldn't recommend that career, because you are in front of a classroom and addressing them. Some leadership skills, because you do have to tell students what to do and how to go about doing tasks. And a great deal of creativity, I think, to create interesting lessons.
How do you recommend that people develop their teaching skills? Is there a good resource for developing these skills?
A resource is always feedback from colleagues, having peer observations or developmental observations. In other words, the idea that it's never ready, you're never done, you never know it all. And also keeping at the back of my mind that professional development is important. So attending conferences and reading in the field and trying out new things. So being aware of what's new. And I think a great deal of reflective thinking. I think with teaching, one needs to evaluate what happened. Sometimes at the beginning of your career, it's good to discipline oneself and do it more rigorously. Let's write a reflective feedback of the lesson I've just taught. But then as you become more experienced, I think it's also very important to look back and say, was this a good class? Was this a good semester? What worked? What needs to be improved?
What recommendations do you have for those who are thinking of entering the teaching profession?
I think the first question is, like, do you really want to be a teacher? I have somebody I know who thought they wanted to become a teacher, and when they actually went into the field, they realized the amount of work it is. It's a tremendous amount of work, so I think one needs to be aware of that. That you need to like it, because if you don't like it, it's not something that you can just jump through the hoops. And the other thing I think people need to be aware of is that in terms of compensation, teaching is a profession that is not very well paid, but also to think about how rewarding it is to meet people from different cultures and to know that you learn all the time from your students.
What recommendations do you have for English learners who would like to pursue a career in teaching English?
Right. I would say that being a non-native speaker teacher of English as a second language is an asset, because like your students, you have gone through the process of learning the language. You are better equipped to understand what they are going through. Whereas if English is your first language, you may not empathize with what it's like to learn a second language. If you think not being a native speaker of English is an obstacle, you're wrong, because it's actually something that gives you another set of skills.
Is there something that you would like to add with respect to becoming a teacher?
No, I would say it's a very rewarding field because it is intellectually stimulating, and you are involved with other people and you can use your creativity. I think those would be my final words.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Have a pleasant day.
Okay, thanks. Bye. Nice talking to you. Bye.
Yeah, good talking to you too. I'm John Russell.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explain American English expressions a little more in depth. Like many languages, English has many expressions that come from the world of animals. Today, we hear about a beautiful bird that gives us a rather sad expression. Christopher Jones Cruz brings us that story.
The white swan, with its long, graceful neck, is among the most beautiful of birds. The swan is mostly silent through its life. It floats quietly on the water, unable to sing sweet songs like most other birds. In ancient times, however, people believed that the swan was given a special gift of song at the end of its life. They believed a swan sings a most beautiful song just before it dies. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates talked of this more than 2,300 years ago. Socrates explained that the swan was singing because it was happy. The bird was happy because it was going to serve the Greek god Apollo. Swans were holy to Apollo, the god of poetry and song. The story of the swan's last song found a place in the works of other writers, including the early English writers Chaucer and Shakespeare. And the expression swan song has long been a part of the English language. At first, swan song meant the last work of a poet, musician, or writer. Now, it means the final effort of any person. Someone's swan song usually is also considered that person's finest work. A political expression with a similar meaning is the last hurrah. The expression may be used to describe a politician's last campaign, his final attempt to win the cheers and votes of the people. The last hurrah also can mean the last acts of a politician before his term in office ends. Writer Edwin O'Connor made the expression popular in 1956. He wrote a book about the final years in the political life of a longtime mayor of Boston, Massachusetts. He called his book The Last Hurrah. Some language experts say the expression came from a name given to noisy supporters of Andrew Jackson, America's seventh president. They cheered hurrah so loudly for Andy Jackson during his presidential campaign that they became known as the Hurrah Boys. Jackson's Hurrah Boys also played a part in the election to choose the next president. Jackson's choice was his vice president, Martin Van Buren. A newspaper of the time reported that Van Buren was elected president, in its words, by the Hurrah Boys, and those who knew just enough to shout hurrah for Jackson. So President Jackson really heard his last hurrahs in the campaign of another candidate, the man who would replace him in the White House.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Join us again next week as we explore more common expressions in American English. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet, guys looking good, down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
4 forward, drift into the right a little. 30 seconds forward. Drift.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy.
Boy. Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history, that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.